Welcome to Side Streets, a podcast about the history and geography of London. I'm Alan Hertz, Professor Emeritus of Humanities at Hull International Business School. Despite my accent, I've been prowling London and learning about its past for over 40 years. Side Streets is a Black Lab Media production, and my producer and editor is Wilhelm Schenk. The past two episodes have developed a proposition that regularizing the physical geography of the Thames and suppressing its riverside subcultures were necessary to make London a modern city. Let me be clear, those processes were not inevitable or progressive or even ethical. Much environmental abuse and human injustice was involved, and maybe a different approach to the river would have given us a nicer city. We can't know. In any case, as I worked on those scripts, I realized that I had unwittingly set myself a challenge. I would have to work out how another notoriously unruly riverside neighborhood fit into my scheme. Medieval and early modern Southwark, that is, the area where Shakespeare worked, might be an exception, a very significant one, and a theory with a hole that big isn't much of a theory. So here is an answer to my own challenge. Over the next two episodes, we'll take a walk along the river from the west end of Tooley Street to Millennium Bridge, and we will try to see not what is there now, but what we would have seen in roughly 1600. What would Shakespeare have experienced as he made his way to work at the Globe? Eventually, we will be asking some tricky questions. Was Southwark tamed in a different way from Wapping? If so, how and why? I feel like I'm on safe ground when considering the environmental metamorphosis of the area. Nowhere along the Thames has the topography been more completely transformed than here. Where Borough Market and Southwark Cathedral are today was once an island. In Roman times, the whole area was islands laced with channels. The land was marshy and the shoreline ill-defined. It's hard now even to get a glimpse of the riverside's original geography. With an increasingly baffled friend, a loyal listener to this podcast, thank you for your patience in it, I made a hopeful trek downstream from Tower Bridge to the one surviving outlet of the River Neckinger. Once there were three, a miniature estuary. But we didn't even find flowing water. Only a soggy strip of sludge enclosed with cement walls, pocked with rubbish and lined with blocks of apparently unoccupied flats. In Southwark, the tributary streams of the Thames haven't just been canalized, they have been obliterated, and the river itself has been completely reformed. In fact, the area has been subjected to several generations of re-engineering. The tourist-clogged promenade of Bankside is a recent creation, of course, and it replaces another man-made riverscape of quays and wharves, only a bit of which survives in almost unrecognizable form. The central space in Hayes Galleria, for example, was once a wet dock. St. Mary's Overy Dock, once a valuable perk of the local priory, is now cut off from the river by a concrete wall. It is occupied by a modern replica of Sir Francis Drake's Golden Hind, which hosts pirate-themed birthday parties. We are a long way from what the Romans saw when they arrived, and almost as far from what Shakespeare would have known. East of the city, as we saw last time, taming the culture of customary practices, urban foraging, smuggling, and black markets was difficult, but straightforward. The forces of authority and capital and law could act without restraint or conflict of interest. Mudlarks and scuffle hunters had few influential friends, and it was easy to distinguish the tamers from the wildlife to be tamed. Patrick Cahoon could present himself as an embodiment of law and order, an East London Wyatt Earp cleaning up the mean docks of Wapping. In Southwark, the task was much more complicated, and the reason for this is shocking. The rowdy subculture of the area was backed by, regulated by, enthusiastically enjoyed by the most powerful figures in England. Southwark was a place of sponsored, managed wildness. Maybe managed wildness sounds like a contradiction in terms. So let me stretch my dubious metaphor a bit further. For centuries, much of Riverside Southwark was a very public, very profitable game park, where wildlife, literally as well as figuratively, flourished under the eyes of, at the behest of, under the control of, for the benefit of, the most important institutions and individuals in the city and the realm. Not only did they profit from the disorder, they regarded it as a civic amenity, conveniently close, safely distant, irresistibly lucrative. Those of you who have been with me from the start may recall my explorations of edginess, the peculiar quality of neighborhoods just beyond the city's jurisdiction, in episodes about Whitechapel and Whitecross Street. In those areas, we found features that were not tolerated in the city, brothels, dissenting chapels, theaters, but that Londoners would not do without. Shakespeare's Southwark was edgy, too, but to a far greater extent. Its dubious, dangerous attractions were controlled by and to some extent part of the city. The church, the crown, the great nobility were patrons and sponsors too, and protected elements in the area which the city might have wanted to suppress. On our imaginary walk, I want to explore this complexity further. By doing so, I will, I hope, make managed wildness less of a contradiction in terms. So let's be off. Roman Southwark was busy, but not particularly edgy. Recent excavations have found industrial and port facilities there, but also some very impressive buildings which apparently housed important bureaucracies. And our first stop is the medieval successor of those offices. From the moment of its conception, what we now call Old London Bridge was intended to be an emblem of civic pride. It could only be built after a royal charter had given the city control over the river, so it was a consequence and an embodiment of the Corporation of London's growing power. Its construction deserves an episode of its own. The design was unprecedented in scale and complexity. Its realization took a lifetime and cost roughly 150 lives. The project was funded in part by a tax on wool, in part by the benefaction of rich citizens looking for credit in heaven and on earth. They were so enthusiastically generous that more money was raised than was needed. Moreover, once it was complete, the bridge continued to generate income. From the offerings of travelers at the Chapel of St. Thomas halfway across, from rents on the houses built along its length, from further gifts and bequests. All this money became the endowment for the Bridge House Estate, a charity which still maintains many of London's bridges, but has lots left over, over £30 million last year, for other good works. This complicated organization, developer, landlord, maintenance team, bank, charity, had its headquarters, Bridge House, more or less where the railroad station is now. It was almost as impressive as the bridge itself. I think we would now call it a campus. It had offices, of course, but also its own dock and warehouses, its own housing for dozens of clerks, masons, rent collectors, and other employees, its own vegetable gardens and orchards to feed them. It even had its own vineyard. A significant fraction of the population of Southwark must have lived there. Bridge House was a city institution. Eventually, the offices moved to the Guildhall, but for several centuries, it wasn't in the city. The ward of Bridge Without, which covered that part of Southwark, was not created until 1550, a few decades before Shakespeare would have known it. So the neighborhood was, here at least, as bureaucratic and respectable as any other part of the city. Borough Market has a long and complicated lineage. One of its ancestors was the enormous fair, one of the three largest in England, held for 2 weeks every September in St. George's Fields, where Borough Underground Station is now. Other antecedents of the modern market were the competing street fairs held three times a week. One was beside St. Thomas's Hospital, another was at the Southwark end of London Bridge, and others were in the yards of the coaching inns of Long Southwark, as Borough High Street was then known. In the Middle Ages, the one by the hospital was regulated by the Archbishop of Canterbury, the one in the street by the Crown, and the smaller markets were technically illegal, but all merged into one another and must have been indistinguishable to customers. Much of London's fresh food was sold and bought here. By Shakespeare's time, the markets were all regulated by the city authorities, but they still occupied every available space in and around Long Southwark. At least 4 days a week, where we are standing now, in the open space at the southern end of the bridge, would have been clogged with wagons and stalls and animals and shoppers. So not just bureaucratic, but also intensely commercial, and again, effectively part of the city. Before we proceed further west, let's pause for refreshment on Long Southwark. This is harder than it sounds, since in 1450 there were 27 premises selling alcohol on the street, and the number could only have gone up since then. Many of these were coaching inns, arcaded quadrangles built around large courtyards. They were busy and complicated places, acting as meeting rooms, performance spaces, markets, workshops, bus stations, motels. Let's stop at the George, because a fragment of it still survives today as a pub, because it has a courtyard for fine weather drinking, a courtyard where one of those satellite markets would once have operated. As we drink, let's look across Long Southwark at Suffolk Place, also known as the Mint. You might remember Charles Brandon, Duke of Suffolk, from the various versions of Hilary Mantel's Wolf Hall trilogy that dominated our screens a few years ago. Among the family's many titles was Knight Marshal, which gave them authority over the Marshalsea prison just down the road from our inn-yard table. On Long Southwark, Brandon rebuilt the family home as one of London's greatest townhouses, a spectacular confection of turrets and gables and mullioned windows. Too spectacular, really, since Henry VIII liked it so much that he took it from Brandon and gave it to Jane Seymour as a wedding present. When she died, it became a mint. Although it was demolished in 1557, the area continued to be called the Mint and retained some legal autonomy because of its former status and function. By Shakespeare's time, it was notorious, a small wilderness of alleys and tenements, the residents of which had some immunity from arrest. Weirder still, those supposedly serving time in the King's Bench, the other local prison, would pay the warden a fee and live an unconstrained life in the Mint. This was not a bribe. The arrangement was customary and quite public. So beside the market was a neighborhood of criminals protected by the state. I could go on for a bit about Southwark's prisons. There were five altogether, but you finished your pint, so let's get back to our walk. Montague Place, where Borough Market is now, emerged in the late 1400s as one of London's first immigrant neighborhoods. Flemish artisans moved here to avoid the restrictions of the city livery companies, which controlled skilled crafts on the other side of the river. So next to a market regulated by the city was a neighborhood of workshops sited there to avoid city control. These businesses may have been operating outside the commercial regulations of the time, but their customer list was impressive. Barnard Flower, for example, was Henry VII's royal glazier and created perhaps the most celebrated stained glass in England, the chapel windows of Eton College and King's College, Cambridge. Another of Flower's patrons was his neighbor, the Bishop of Winchester. We will come back to him. And Flower apparently used the library in the bishop's palace to research his designs. Although the stained glass trade was ruined by the Reformation and Flower was dead by Shakespeare's time, other Flemish artisans were still active in the area. They included goldsmiths, sculptors of funeral monuments, potters imitating Chinese designs, reasonable blackmen, a silk weaver from West Africa, was working in Montague Place in the 1570s. This community had deep local roots, was very prosperous and intensely respectable. They endowed local schools and almshouses, but although it flourished for well over a century, its status must always have been slightly uncertain. Although it was patronized and supported by the greatest in the land, it operated outside the formal economic system of the times, and aliens, as people of foreign birth were called, were subject to state surveillance and occasional street violence. But Montague Place was such a success that the Worshipful Company of Glaziers, the city guild that Flower and his fellows once crossed the river to avoid, now has its hall and headquarters in Montague Close, the surviving remnant of their neighborhood. It is, I think, the only livery company hall south of the river, and the glaziers, delightfully, share it with the launderers and the scientific instrument makers. So bureaucracy, commerce, manufacturing, and an emerging pattern of patronage and protection. At this point, you may be wondering what was so unruly about Shakespeare's Southwark. Perhaps some of the markets and workshops operated outside the law, but you could have found similar anomalies anywhere just outside the city walls, and the most superficial acquaintance with our own London will tell us that such irregularities are not inconsistent with modernity. If this is as bad as Bankside got, no taming was necessary. But on our walk west, we have arrived at the edge of the Winchester Liberty, and Southwark is about to get much wilder. I will save that for next time. Let's draw some conclusions from what we have seen so far. First of all, much of Southwark was as respectable as anywhere in London. Bridge House was an imposing complex of buildings and an important city institution. Second, much of what looks like confusion to us had a purpose. The traffic on the bridge and on Long Southwark was a great subject of complaint for centuries. Diarists, travelers, journalists moaned about it the way modern Londoners moan about train delays or the weather. But the congestion wasn't just the accidental byproduct of increasingly dense settlement and human activity. It was intentional. The Bridge House Trust built the houses that famously narrowed the roadway on the bridge and maintained them with great ingenuity and at great expense. The bridge generated so much rental income that all proposals to build more bridges across the river were resisted, not just by the livery company of boatmen, who stood to lose valuable trade, but by the city corporation itself. Likewise, the market that clogged Long Southwark, London's main arterial road to the south, might have been moved or restricted in size or opening hours, but instead it was expanded and allowed to operate on more days of the week. The congestion of the area was so profitable that it was worth the trouble. In fact, it was encouraged. Given a choice between cleaning up the neighborhood and maximizing returns, the city chose the latter. Third, even where the city stood to lose, other patrons were available. The Flemish glaziers, weavers, and potters of Montague Place competed with city craftspeople, but they drew their customers from the elite, who made sure they stayed in business. Fourth, everywhere in Shakespeare's Southwark, the boundaries between the legal and the illegal, the orderly and the disorderly, the legitimate and the contraband, were difficult to draw. Fifth, the process of taming the area was not linear or straightforward. The Mint is a good example of these two final points, and we will discover others in the next episode. Well, that's enough for now. Next time, we will continue our walk through the Winchester Liberty and the Theater District down to Paris Gardens. It will be wild. Thanks for listening. This episode was researched, written, and presented by me, Alan Hertz. Side Streets is a Black Lab Media production, and my producer and editor is Wilhelm Schenk.